Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts,
MSLS Rusty Edge.
National Space Station, that should be worth a bunch of science.
Yeah.
What happened to all my gold income? Oh.
You can use the ISS as a weapon when you don't want to pay money for its like, upkeep anymore. Just drop it on someone.
All right, let's align the International Space Station right over my biggest opponent's capital, and no more support.
Wham!
So, Doug, I see in your forum profile, last name of Smith. Is that all right to be saying on the show? Because it wasn't in your forum profile. I just knew your first name.
It's all right for here, I guess. The rest of you use your real names, I imagine. Being Smith is anonymous enough as it is.
Okay.
You know, you can try and find me on the internet, but it's pretty hard to find the right one.
Doug Smith.
Oh, no, 5 million hits.
It's kind of like that.
I'll look for the Doug that talks about, I was on Polycast, it was awesome.
You assume he thinks it was awesome.
Whoa.
Whoa. Mackie's starting a rap.
Mackie rap, yeah.
That's what happens when you drink too much coffee for Polycast.
This is episode 61 with your host, Dan Quick. Say hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Special guest, me, MSLS on the forums, Michael Lucas Smith, and all the awesome regulars, Makalua. Hi, Mackie.
Hello.
Imran Siddiqui.
Hi.
God, even I can pronounce that.
Mekalaka, hi, Mekasiddiqui.
Katamandua.
Hi.
And very special guest, Doug Rusty Edge R. Smith.
Hello.
Research lab, we looked at my idea, A Matter of Time.
In the Senate, we discussed a redux topic, our favorite leader traits, how to deal with siege, and is cavalry overpowered?
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Time was the idea I had for Civ, which is that when we play the game, we play it in a god's eye view. We look down upon the world and the world changes over time and we command the entire battlefield all at once. And there's no penalty for distance except with economy and that corruption, and that's changed in every single Civ game. But I think the real penalty should exist in information. What you know about the world. What you know about the world changes based on how fast you can get information back to your capital or to your lords or vassals or defense towers or various other implements of information capturingness that people have suggested in the comments, which means that the world looks different to you than it does to other players in the game. How the world looks to you is based on how fast information has gotten back to you. So if you send out troops to go to war, then in the very early Stone Age part of the game, this could be a really bad idea because the further they get away from your capital, the less information you know about what's going on. So by the time they actually find an enemy to attack, that's probably 10, 20 turns away of information. It's very old. So if they're ever even going to come home, you don't know. As opposed to in the Middle Ages, where you actually have horse and you've got roads set up, information flows back to you faster. So you're capable of having a bigger empire. And then the very modern age, where you have radio towers and satellites, etc., where you can deal with the entire world. And this is the real limiting factor in civilizations. So when you sit down and play Civ and you're playing on a medium to high level, one of the important things that you have to do is to spread as fast as possible to take up as much room as you can. Well, if you can actually pull that off in a matter of time, you're playing really well because your cities are going to be so far away from your capital and you're not going to have the technologies to spread information fast enough to really see what's going on in your border towns. So if somebody decides to attack you, you have a limited capacity to respond, unless you've planned really well and put a big bunch of units in there. And that's the general gist, is that the technologies change your ability to know what's going on in the world.
I like it.
I mean, it's a pretty different kind of game. I was told that there are games similar to that, but I've never seen one on the scale of Civilization.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, I don't think it's possible to do it in Civ 4, simply because it means that every square looks different to every player, and I don't think the game actually supports that.
Well, I wonder if a Civ 5 would even support something like it.
Well, if that was your premise from the outset, then you would design it so it could take that into account.
Yeah.
Well, it's true, but I don't think Civ 5 will be designed like that from the outset. But, I mean, I really do like the idea. Issue is, of course, you know, the board would look different to every person. I guess what you could do is, I don't know if you were trying to make it into a Civ 4 or even Civ 5 mod, you could kind of temper that down a little bit and kind of add in kind of a fog of war. Maybe it's the same type of world map, but you could have something like a fog of war or whatever, and which would work in the ways that you're describing with time, whereas you only get information about a certain amount of your cities based on, you know, whatever your governors tell you or something like that, and how long it would take usually to get that information. So maybe it'd be a different kind of fog of war. Not like what we have now, but something...
A fog of time.
A fog of time. I mean, I do think it'd be a very interesting type of situation. One of the big problems in ruling an empire back, hell, 500 years ago or something like that, was you didn't know what was going on the extremes of your empire, and things would happen, and you'd find out about it sometime later, and you'd be like, wow, the War of 1812 was started between the U.S. and the U.K. because, you know, of problems with communication over at sea.
And one of the most impressive empires of its time was the Khan's empire. Because it was just so big, and with such limited technology, very few roads that span the empire, mostly just controlled by a set of ethics bred by horseback, and those ethics weren't particularly ethical. Compared to the Roman Empire, which was controlled by road, basically. I think this is a really important part of describing civilizations in terms of how they grow and evolve and collapse, and...
Mm.
And different forms of government actually make sense at that point, too, because when you have the ability to install lords in different parts of the country, they can make decisions on your behalf, and that was kind of the point, which essentially means that you get information faster.
Yeah.
And it would also mean that building forts would even make sense.
Other than choke points.
You can tie in, like, different governments could bring you information more quickly, which could make, you know, another different civics could add to your knowledge as well as technology. I mean, of course, as you go across the tech tree, there'll be different techs that will give you quicker access to knowledge, but also civics could do that as well. A lot of throughout history, one of the things that rulers have been trying to get is trying to get their information quicker. Because, of course, if you can do that, then you have an advantage over your opponent that you are fighting against or that you are trying to diplomatically outwit.
Exactly. Take democracy, for example. Prior to our modern age, democracy was pretty much a death sentence for your civilization. Even though it was a great idea, it didn't scale. It took, basically, modern technology to make it possible. If you build the pyramids, to pull in the Civ 4 concept, you build the pyramids, you have access to all these different types of governments, you'd be daft to go to one of the later ones without the supporting infrastructure.
Mm.
You would have a much greater emphasis on putting together a network of espionage and diplomacy, because this is how you would know what was even going on in other nations, much less your own.
Oh, yeah. Embassies would actually be really useful. The first time you meet a civilization, they're going to be very small like you. And by the time you arrive with your stack of doom, they're going to be big like you. You can't just take the assumption that they're going to sit on their laurels and do nothing.
Mm.
You just don't know what's going on out there anymore. Barbarian nations rise, armies arrive on your doorstep. Your diplomatic lines and keeping an eye on everything going on is really important.
Question. Would you be able to pull an Alexander the Great and go with your army and then have to get news back from home?
Yeah, I think you should be able to. I mean, in Civ 4, you can move your palace, and it's meaningless in the game, basically. If you had a large empire in this variation, you would want to put your palace in the middle. All the information filters back that way. So I guess it makes sense that you should be able to move your center of knowledge around. If you've got the old empire, which is fairly stable, and you're fairly sure no one's going to rock up on the backside of your empire until people start arriving in boats, then, yeah, you'd probably want to shift your seat of power towards where you need it most. That's a very Caesarish thing to do as well, because Caesar went out and fought his wars.
I wonder, though, on the idea, though, how would colonization to begin with work? Because if you have to wait for them to get you information, they would have to work differently, wouldn't it?
Well, orders would have to be different in general.
Hmm.
You would tell a unit, I want you to go and do this thing, right? And if he's all the way out 20 squares away from your palace and it's the Stone Age and you tell him to do something else, you have to have the assumption that it's going to take a little time for that order to get to him.
Hmm.
As well as you seeing that what he's done. So workers you would probably manage differently. Certainly soldiers you would manage differently.
Yeah.
And you would preempt a lot of things. It would be a bit like playing diplomacy where you write down what you're going to do and then you do it as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you tell your units what you want them to do and you hope that that's what actually ends up happening.
It would be a little bit more automized type of activity.
Well, I don't think it's actually that different to now, except that when you tell a unit to do something, it's not immediate.
Mm.
And you're also going to have to be counting on the AI is going to interpret what you tell it to do properly. That might be another little hurdle there.
Yeah. I think setting a unit I work at to automate, probably not such a great idea.
In terms of, say, real-life colonization, most countries just sent out ships with a few settlers or explorers and just said, all right, go to whatever you can and set up a city, basically, or set up an outpost or something like that. Perhaps in some ways there would have to be a little bit more automation in order to make it work better. Because in some respects you might want, like say for colonizing, you might want them to get down to business and not have to wait for you to send a message back to them saying, okay, now you can get off the boat and you can make a city there.
Yeah, you would like be telling the caravel or the galley or whatever it is they're going to go on, go to here, and then you tell the units as well. And when you get there, get off and do this. I think I mentioned in the post as well the idea that the further away your lines of communication are, there's a threshold to your ability to control them. So if you build a city on another continent and it's effectively 50 turns away, then they're going to become a separate colony. You're not going to have control over them anymore. The ability to actually tell them what to do is gone. And that's really realistic. That happens on all scales. And they can still be friendly with you. It's just, you know, you're effectively not in control of them, so you wouldn't be.
Hmm.
I know in an earlier episode we had talked about in terms of colonies and Civilization 4 and how they're different from Civilization 3, and some people desired the idea of, oh, I don't want to have to set up a separate city to get that particular resource. I don't want to have my cultural borders expand. I just want to be able to take something, have a unit in there to protect it, to get that resource, hook it up to my network, and it could be that, yes, if an AI then moved into that area and then that became part of its fat cross immediately or later on, then that colony would be absorbed and that would be the end of it. Someone, I believe, in the thread on CFC suggested the idea of having outposts set up, a function that a worker could do, for instance, so that if you're talking about having a city set up so far away, whether it's on another continent or just a number of tiles a little farther away on the particular continent that you're already on, you could improve, and it still wouldn't be instantaneous like it is right now, but you could have a series of outposts that would then relay information. The idea being that what's happening in the game is from your capital, you send the order to outpost one, and then it gets sent on to outpost number two, et cetera, until it gets to the city. The mechanics of how many tiles away, how far can that outpost see, how far can that communicate, because that could also be getting you information sent back to you on a regular basis of what this particular tile or these series of tiles looked like X number of turns ago, which could then be improved with technologies, which could be improved with civics. So that way it's not quite so difficult to manage getting into the middle game as compared to the early game, but before you have the advantage of technologies which, like radio, for instance, or television, or the internet, for more instant communication.
Torch towers.
No, it's not Lord of the Rings.
They really used torch towers, even in the Roman days.
I know. It's just the first thing that popped in my head.
Ah, geek.
Yes, and in the Torch Tower, try not to torch the tower. Random events, son of a...
Your Torch Tower was torched. You could not tell your units anything. Uh-oh.
And later on in the game, you could still have those Torch Towers, but you'd have to buy some carbon offset credits.
I think by later on in the game, you could use, you know, more advanced communication techniques.
Satellites.
I think attacking somebody's infrastructure in this kind of game would be really interesting. If you decided to attack one of their cities that's on the outside of their empire, probably one of the first things you would want to do is cut off their means of communicating, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to get information back no matter what, but how fast, right?
Yeah, cut off the roads and...
And disable their ability to get horse, you know, that sort of thing. Then suddenly, information about that city's lost. It could be 20 turns later that you discovered you won the fight, but... which is really embarrassing for the guy attacking. But that would be a really smart strategy. Even in the modern game, if you attack their satellites and you attack their radio towers... Radio towers were actually on the map and you attack them. This actually makes sense, I think. I'd like to add a different twist to this particular topic, which is the idea of posting on the forums. I was hesitant to do it, not having been much of a forum poster at all, even though this is like a pulse and I find podcasting more exciting than forums. It was really good getting the feedback from CFC and Appleton and even on my blog, seeing people like the idea. And there was one guy who thought it was a crappy idea. But most people were really into it. So, yeah, thanks everybody who commented. And if you've got a crazy idea for Civ, I recommend you sign up to these forums and post it on there and get some feedback. It's cool.
Yes, sign up on Appleton forums. That's right.
I couldn't say that because I'm biased being the owner, but I assure you Imran is not.
Indeed, and never will be.
But in all seriousness, this approach could help improve the later game, because some people say, oh, later game, it gets so boring, there's not as many interesting things happening anymore. Well, in the later game, you're going to be able to see more things that are going on. You will have it so that you don't have to be quite so reactive or take such big proactive steps that are a big gamble, right, that could really pay off or come back to bite you in the ass. Because up until that point, until the later game, you haven't had that ability. You haven't had that god game ability where, okay, this turn I'm going to send this order to that unit. That unit is going to get that order this turn, and at some point then be able to act on that order that turn, some combinations thereof. So that there's actually something to look forward to in the later game, as opposed to, okay, well, it's 1900 AD. I'm either A, going to win, or B, I'm screwed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the differences between our previous civilizations and modern civilizations is the ability to organize en masse, right? We're really productive in the first world, really, really productive. And that's basically our lines of our communication, our technology, and our resources. That's what would happen in the modern game, is that your civilization, the cost of everything in your borders would be one turn. You're back to playing the regular game. But if you decide to enact campaigns overseas in a war, you're going to have a bit of lag, a couple of turns, possibly less, depending on your satellite network and your ability to communicate with the troops on the ground, with radios and stuff like that. Yeah, your foreign diplomacy is still a gamble, but there's this problem with the AI, and that the AI to keep up with people has to cheat. But that's only because you can see everything at once. You can affect the entire world in one go. If you're playing with continents and you can't actually just go and settle on their continent and take them over because there's this time lag thing, then the only way you're ever going to get an opportunity to wipe them out is with technology, with the modern age. You can't just go over to a large empire on the other side of the world and just obliterate them effectively without the ability to communicate. So, I think that gives the AI an actual chance of being interesting in the later game as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little less of a godlike position the player is in, and a bit more dependent on the actual sources of knowledge.
Yeah, like Mackie said, with the espionage as well. Especially in the later game, if you don't have spies everywhere. You've got no idea what they're building, what they're doing, or anything like that. And you can't really disrupt their ability to communicate and organize as well.
It's always great to have a better AI, and you'll be delegating more things to the AI, and in some ways it's going to be an AI versus AI combat if it's very far away.
I agree with that, because that's the penalty of time, isn't it?
It reminds me of when I used to play a hot seat game with about 8 teams, and they were all me. You know, you get a different perspective on the world, and you really don't know how it all fits together.
Me is such a jerk.
Well, that's the same thing. Me versus me is like AI versus AI. It's kind of a stalemate at some point. And it would favor the defender because they'd have the most current information.
Well, that's actually the point. That's realistic.
It's very interesting. Very fun. I have the feeling I'd see a lot of threads on the forum. This sucks. Incredibly interesting idea.
So Michael will start programming on that next week, and
we'll have it by a month from now. Is that?
Yeah. Next topic.
He's like, I realized I have to do something. I'll see you later.
All right, Imran, what do you want next?
A beer. What? Oh, you mean a topic? The rest of them describe stuff that's actually in the game.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
A bit of a redux again, like in episode 60, where we talked about our favorite civics. We're now going back to our favorite leader traits, which we last talked about in episode 20, another first season episode back in July of 2007. So I'm just going to quickly run through not what the benefits of each trait is, unless we're going to talk about it specifically in alphabetical order, meaning that you have Warlords, which introduced a couple of new traits: aggressive, creative, charismatic, expansive, financial, imperialistic, industrious, organized, philosophical, protective, and spiritual. Now, I'm going to say something that may fall under the Captain Obvious and Commander Duh category, but if you're going to choose which trait you would like, pair something with financial.
I knew that's where you were going.
Anybody want to disagree with that?
Dan is trying to sound like he knows what he's talking about here, but he only just recently learned this lesson.
Just the other day, actually.
After which I told Michael because he was still clueless.
Oh, so harsh.
Lies.
Who was clueless? Harsh.
Thank you, Mackie.
And this is why I don't play with you guys.
So then I guess then the question becomes, after financial, and this may be where things get interesting and even also semi-relates to the related topic, which is what people think is the worst trait. Now, we have 11 traits here total. I just went with kind of a top five. Even then, I'm not going to categorize it as a top five because it will depend in part whether or not you view yourself as a warmonger more so or a builder as more so. Pairing with financial, creative. So if we're looking strictly at leaders then, and I'll mention both the leaders as well as what expansion packs you need, if any. Of course, that's William Varenya of the Netherlands and Beyond the Sword. Although I had forgotten, but you could have financial and creative on the Vanilla Sephora if you went with Catherine, Russia. Also like protective. So that's Wen Kong of Korea, introduced in Warlords. Also introduced in Warlords was Hannibal, who has charismatic and financial. And I actually made a recent switch. I had said aggressive, but I've now changed my mind, moving up on the higher difficulty levels, and instead of aggressive at fifth, I make it sixth. I say organized at number five. That can be Darius of Persia now, and it used to be Washington of America back on Vanilla. So financial, and then creative, protective, charismatic, and organized.
I can't remember which one gives you a discount on wonders. Which one gives you a discount on wonders? Is it industrious?
Industrial.
Yes.
Industrious.
When you get to the higher levels, one of the things that ruins you is the finances, and having the financial trait is not necessarily always enough. So being able to build the Colossus and the Byroli minaret can really save you. So that minor, very small extra advantage on building wonders can be very useful. But if you're playing Pangaea, your intent is to wipe everybody out well before you get to the point where inflation destroys you, then it doesn't matter. But if you've got continents, if you've got AIs over the water, you're in it for the long haul,
You need to be able to have a stable economy for the entire game. And either capturing those wonders or building those wonders, yeah, that matters.
Yeah, just capture that one city full of 20 wonders and raise your team score.
On that same note, expansive, because it will also give you 25% faster production of workers. And it just allows you to grow faster because it also double production speed on Granary Harbor, and you also get +2 health per city. So you can expand really fast, hence the name, without the expansive trait.
Except for the financial effects.
Yes.
And you still can't expand as fast as an Emperor level AI, unfortunately.
Oh, dear. I'm afraid Annalie and I are going to be at odds. But first off, the 25% worker production point that was introduced beyond the sword.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And the +2 health per city and the double production speed of Granary and Harbor, that was in vanilla. But I ranked expansive actually lower down on my list. Not so much because of expansive of itself, but because of what other ones bring you. Michael already brought up industrious because of the wonder production increase 50%. Financial +1 commerce on plots with 2 commerce, double production speed of bank. But it's +1 commerce on plots that I really like. Creative +2 culture per city. That's what I like. Yeah, there's double production speed of theater and coliseum. It's really the +2 culture. Protective, now that gives drill 1 and city garrison 1 promotions to both archery and gunpowder units automatically. There's also the double production speed of walls and castles, which definitely has an impact. And then charismatic, higher difficulty levels, the +1 happiness per city, particularly if you are want for a religion. And yes, of course, there is the whipping factor that we've talked about before to help keep unhappiness down. And that's the big part of charismatic. But then there's also -25% XP needed for unit promotions. And yeah, there's the +1 happiness for monument and broadcast tower. But it's really the +1 happiness per city and then the -25% XP needed for unit promotions. And then why organize the civic upkeep reduced 50%, which kind of goes towards inflation and your economy going down la chatour.
El crapper.
And then, yes, there's double production speed of lighthouse and courthouse. And, of course, courthouse is also very beneficial in reducing your upkeep costs. But I'm sorry, Annalie. Ranking them out of 11, I actually have expansive at number 10. Ooh, awkward.
Jump off a bridge.
It's because we've turned him into a warmonger. If he was a builder, still a pure builder, he'd probably value it higher.
Yeah, he's going far right now. He needs to come back to the middle somehow.
Somewhere.
What are you guys doing to him?
Oh, we're having fun.
So is he, actually.
I guess Michael would place Industrious in his top 5. At least top 5 is expansive.
Yeah, financial, organized, charismatic, industrious, creative, maybe.
All right, that's most of what on my list. You can be invited back. Okay.
Yeah, except I disagree about protective. I those civs are just annoying.
When you go to wipe them out, yeah.
No. That's why you become one of them.
Sitting Bull in particular. Gimme, 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 gimme.
Are you going to start singing ABBA now? Well, I don't know.
No. I'm not well-versed on ABBA. I didn't know that was a song.
Yeah, I tend to agree that creative and defensive traits, they're beginner traits. You don't need them, and they don't ultimately give you that much when you're playing a bigger game. There's nothing that you can't do yourself, basically, so you may as well not have accepted them as a leader trait.
Yeah, you could do it yourself, but why not let the trait help you? Shall we then discuss the worst trait?
I think aggressive is the worst one. Being aggressive has nothing to do with having the aggressive trait.
Protective, I hate it.
No, protective is great.
Sorry there, Doug. Protective isn't even on the freaking poll.
Well, I know. That's why I had to bring it up. It wasn't even on the poll for worse, because it goes without saying, right?
Oh.
Oh. As I said, Doug, why don't you just start playing as a protective, someone who has protective, and then you'll like it. See? I solved your problem. Moving on.
Okay.
Yes, this thread I disagreed with because they voted expansive as the worst trait, but that's because they don't play like I play. So, there.
And how is it that you play?
Well, I'm like a builder, don't do a lot of warmongering, And as a builder, expansive is more useful for me. I think these guys are just trying to show off how many times they've gone to war, because that's the way men are. So. Oh, did I say that loud? Sorry.
It's all right, but, you know, sometimes you got to go to war to get that wonder that they stole from you.
Oh, that's different. That's called revenge.
There's our feminist side coming out there when we do that.
Now, see, it's not war for the sake of war. It's war for the sake of, that was mine, dang it.
Totally.
I'm going to have to go with spiritual.
That's what I would have voted to.
I'm not saying that it has no use ever, but I'm just saying, as certainly as compared to the others, I find it to have the least amount of use.
I should point out to the listeners that Dan doesn't understand AI diplomacy yet. And thus he doesn't understand spiritual.
Well, I think spiritual will probably be more useful on a higher level.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. Sometimes I think Ramsey's almost overpowered when you start going the religion and wonder route. People like you when they share your religion.
Well, that's fine. I don't need to have the spiritual trait to go along with that. I could.
If you want to not get destroyed by a giant AI next to you, you need to be able to swap to their religion without wasting time in revolution and changing civics to match as well and then changing back again. You know, that revolution time, getting rid of that, that's a big thing in the higher levels, being able to please everybody around you all the time so that whatever they demand, you can give them. And that gives you the time to build up and become powerful enough to wipe them out.
Well, I don't play on the higher difficulty levels. I'm in the middle of the road, so it's not as critical, see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Context.
How to deal with siege. Zyder posts, a thread on siege weapons made me consider this idea. Perhaps siege are not overpowered, but rather, perhaps their counter, flanking, is underpowered. Then he goes through a number of cases, and they get debates on the various ways to defend against a siege-heavy stack of doom. And enter Artichoker, who, if you go through and read all his posts together, makes more sense than reading the thread post by post and having everybody give you their impression of what he said. Maybe a lot of threads really work this way. Yeah.
Zeder, in his opening post, further to what you were saying, saying, when you see a stack of doom in the late to early game, do you hunker down in the cities, count on defensive bonuses to serve you best, option A. Option B, engage the enemy stack of death in the field, mainly relying on counter siege. Or C, engage enemy stack of death in the field, mainly relying on counter flanking of the siege with horse archers. And he comes to the conclusion that B is the quote-unquote no-brainer. And further, if there are mechanisms or such that case B and C were highly competitive and dependent on situational circumstances, then I'd have to say that siege was not overpowered. A little later on, someone who says he hardly ever posts at all but felt the need to post on this one, CYBA Kirbytron, says that in Civilization there are multiple solutions to every single encounter and every single detail counts. And he goes through a number of questions which are quite good, actually.
I can paraphrase, though. Or it depends.
It's the summary of every polycast ever.
Brilliant! This is such a defending stack of doom on a hill or a forest, because then, of course, they get a defensive bonus. Are all units inside the stack at full health? And then also goes into situations such as advanced technologies or abilities to counter the attack. How fast can you produce and move new units into position, and how upgraded will they be? And that, in summary, there are literally hundreds of questions one can ask about how to deal with about an attacking enemy force. Reducing it to an ABC answer scheme is not Civ-like at all. This is true. Doug mentioned Artichoker, and on collateral damage in general, he says that the target units for collateral damage are determined, and then the collateral damage is dealt to the units determined in step number one. So, for example, you might be facing a stack of 14 catapults and 6 pikemen. Assuming you attack with a catapult first, the set of units might be chosen as 1 pikeman and 4 catapults. In this case, the 4 catapults take no damage, and the 1 pikeman takes a normal amount of collateral damage.
Yeah, I always wondered, if you attack with a stack instead of doing it one unit at a time, the computer will pick the optimal way to cause the most damage, the most likely to succeed order of attack for you. So you can kind of bypass some of these decisions just by clicking on your stack of doom and saying attack, and you're going to get, in theory, the optimal outcome. I look at this particular problem from the modern age. If you've got an enemy coming in to attack you and you have attack fighter jets, right, you're going to want to attack them every single square they take to get towards to your city. So, I mean, that's pretty much the answer there. Why is it different in the modern age to the medieval or earlier ages? It's not. You want to attack them the whole way towards wherever their goal is going because you've got optimal chance of reducing them down to nothing. I've been attacked with ridiculously large stacks, and I had my army off somewhere else at the time, so I was building units to defend as they came into my land. And the only reason I survived was because I kept throwing them at the stack as they approached my first city. By the time they got to my first city, there was only a third of the stack left.
And even that stack wasn't particularly healthy now, was it?
No, and it wasn't healthy, so they had to heal themselves, and that gave me plenty of more time to put more units into the city. If I'd waited for them to come to the city, I would have lost the city.
Yeah, I think the difference between doing that in the modern age and early on in the game is practically speaking, how many do you have, how quickly can you get them there, particularly if you're having to build them somewhere else and then transport them to the front.
Yep.
As you say, the goal is the same. Weaken them along the way.
I think somebody did the math once that attacking an attacking stack outside of the city was mathematically superior. I think someone in another forum thread a while ago.
But Civ is supposed to be fun. What are you doing math for? Jeez.
Well, I guess underlying that is if it's a city raid or promotion heavy stack, if you meet it in the field, those are going to be neutralized.
Absolutely.
Unless you're in a fort. If you're in a fort, then the city raider promotions are useful. But if they're just out in the field and you have his artichokers, longbows with guerrilla promotions or something, then it helps you quite a lot.
And when it comes to whether you're going to decide, okay, am I going to try to counterattack first before they can attack me, you know, before moving to the cities, or do I wait? I often use the, which causes delays sometimes in multiplayer games, and some people get annoyed, but that's the way it is. What I'm often doing is, okay, I think I'm going to take this unit, I'm going to attack that unit. What are the combat odds? I'm looking at not only the percentage, but I'm also looking at, okay, this is, I get plus this percent because of this, but they've also got plus percentage of that. And so that can also help you determine what it is you're going to do in a particular situation.
I do that too, Dan, but I do it quickly.
Very overpowered.
Because they are.
No.
Actually, no, I don't agree. They're not overpowered. They're correctly powered.
Right. Vanilla Cossacks, yeah. But
yeah, now that they require more than just rifling, needing military tradition. That was a benefit. What was that? Warlord's change? Beyond the Sword change? I forget.
I don't know.
Somewhere along the line.
I just like to think in terms of in the holistic view. If you're going to take over a continent with horse and guns, it's not quite as easy to take over a foreign power, but taking over your own continent in full with that technology and no one else has it? Yeah, that's about right.
Indeed. So for those listening wondering, what are cavalry in the game? Mounted units, 2 movement, 15 tech, doesn't receive defensive bonuses, can withdraw from combat, 30% chance, plus 50% attack versus cannon. Ah, can flank attack cannons, trebuchets, and catapults. That is the ability I like.
When you hit that age, yeah, the rifles are going to be able to walk over them as well, but getting there fast, that's the cavalry. You can pretty much upgrade them to fight gunpowder units after 1 or 2 fights with non-gunpowder units.
Person who started this thread was Stunted Azrael. He is the one that's saying the cavalry rush is, in my opinion, overpowered, and Beyond the Sword is pushed back in the technology tree, and now it needs rifling, but with that, it doesn't lose its power, it's just delayed, and then goes through how he does it. He's got a peaceful empire with 8-10 cities, standard map, frantically geared toward research, getting rifling and military tradition. After the needed techs are required, switch to nationhood and theocracy, upgrade knights or the cuirassiers, start drafting rifles, and then with cavalry, I'll overrun any neighbor, no need for spies or siege. Only defense that AI can have against this is rifling. Everything else is useless. That's why it's so devastating, unquote. And that really kind of hits on a couple of points we've talked about already that Michael brought up, one being that if it's on this continent, yes.
Well, I mean, I think his problem is that he's playing on an easy level, because if you think this is too powerful, then you haven't come up against the AI at the same tech level as you. You cannot do a cavalry rush if the AI has cavalry as well and rifles. they'll defend quite adequately. So play on a hard level, dude.
It only seems overpowered if you get there first, and they're still on long boats, and you don't have to worry about their walls defense. When you're at a similar tech level, they're not overpowered. They're just about right.
Yeah, I think people have a tendency, like human players versus the computer, have a tendency to rush towards the ability to make cavalry, whereas the AI doesn't necessarily do that. So, yeah, that's always a target for me. I know that if I want to take over the rest of my continent, I'm going to need cavalry, so I'll rush for it. And then I'll take all of my previous units and upgrade them all to cavalry and riflemen with all the gold that I've managed to pillage or get from a great merchant or whatever. But that's pretty realistic. The civilization that ended up with the most powerful technology used it.
And won.
And won. Yeah.
Interestingly, in this thread, Mirthadir actually takes the opposite view where he says, cavalry actually strikes me as underpowered. Their counter comes on the same tech, we've already talked about that, and they require resource. I've always found cursors and cannons to be better beelines. I don't think they're underpowered either.
Yeah, I don't know. Because you don't have the gunpowder advantage over the walls. So, yeah, you have to drag these siege weapons around with you. I don't know.
I'll end this topic by quoting R-Rolo-1, and this relates to something we just talked about, where he says the only thing that is really overpowered in Civ 4 combat is Siege.
Oh, man. Let's just go around in circles. The only thing overpowered in Civ 4 is combat.
No. Let's get to the root of the problem here. The only thing overpowered in Civ 4 are the human players.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast, or about Polycast in general,
log into the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
Like Empire post on CFC, basic civilization definitions, what things in civilization really mean. Like if you send a scout to auto-explore, it basically means someone's a bear. Building the Great Wall, unknown. The AI always constructs it one turn before the player.
Lemon's Rule of Copper. The appearance of copper N tiles from your only city indicates that horses and iron will be N times 25 tiles from your only city in opposite directions.
Thadian's Sid's Tips ones. Sid's Tips. Directions how to lose.
Don't hate on Sid.
In parentheses, does this clown even play?
That wasn't nice.
He's been ex-civnicated.
Wow, that's an interesting term.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Polycast Episode 61 with our gracious and glorious founder and host, Dan Quick.
Thank you.
Carta Mandua.
Bye.
Not to forget, Makalua.
Bye.
Imran Siddiqui.
Bye.
Michael Lucas-Smith.
Bye.
And myself, who's been very honored and delighted to be here, Douglas Rusty Edge. Goodbye.
Yeah, we're going to give you some tips on how to set up a username later.
A different monitor hooked up with Excel up.
Microsoft, if you would like to sponsor the show.
They sponsored the UK nuclear submarines, and that didn't go so well.
No. We can calculate to the infinitesimal decimal just how much we're screwed.
Well, I can use words like fornicating.
Yeah. Whoa. What?
Oh. You're too young for this.
Careful now, he's Canadian. He's not used to such vulgarity.
I see.
That will not be the episode title. Michael, this is the third time you've guest co-hosted on the show. If you were invited back for number 4, and you could, would you? Would you? Would? Yeah, would you?
Would I be?
Would you would if you could and you should?
Well, I don't know if I should, but I would.
Record date January 24th, 2009. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright 2009, Bolton Civilization site at apolton.net.